RNZ National, and a new gap has been exposed in New Zealand's COVID-19 border testing regime. We've had community transmission and the resulting clusters, and we know about the coronavirus cases coming in on international flights landing in New Zealand, which are considered imported cases. And now we have a new way of the coronavirus being transmitted called border incursion. And joining me now to talk through how this happened and how we could improve this is epidemiologist Dr. Michael Baker. Kia ora, Michael.
Kia ora, Karen.
Can you explain how this happened for those who don't know?
Yes, well, I should say that it's still not absolutely clear what happened here. I mean, the significant thing about this case is it's the first one which is linked to a port and shipping. So that makes it very important. We know in the past we've had a number of cases linked to airports and managed isolation and quarantine facilities. We still don't know the origin, of course, of the large Auckland outbreak that started in August. So the jury's really out on that. That could potentially have also been linked to a port. But this is a reminder that while the big focus has been on, obviously, the 500 or so passengers arriving in New Zealand each day, and some of whom are usually positive for COVID-19, we perhaps haven't focused enough on what's happening at ports. And we need to remember that unlike air travel, shipping has probably not declined a great deal during the pandemic, because obviously we've continued with exports and we're continuing to import goods. And at least based on the data before the pandemic, we were having around 100 port visits per week for ships. That's counting every port they visited. So that's a lot of opportunities for things to go wrong if they're not very carefully managed.
So this ship was, you know, moored here, if that's the right term, and these Filipino workers had come into the country and they were boarding this ship here. Why were they boarding a ship here?
Yeah, well, I think I'm sure that's quite a complex question around how the ships are staffed. And as we know, most of the crew are from not from New Zealand or Australia, but often from low and middle-income countries, and often do work for very long periods. And I think it's a very tough life for many crews, and it's got a lot tougher during the pandemic. So I imagine that at times they do give them some relief and allow them to go home and then change crews around. I don't understand all the details. But what I think would be a surprise here to many of us is that this crew flew in and were transferred really very quickly to that ship in Auckland with minimal quarantine and testing. And so obviously they would have been treated as potentially infected throughout that whole process. So given the timing, that is obviously one of the potential sources of infection for the New Zealand worker who was on the ship at about that time.
But there was no testing, was there? They didn't get tested at all when they got here.
No, they didn't. So they bypassed our normal MIQ process. And admittedly, that process is to screen people and quarantine them to the point where they can then leave and enter New Zealand, and they're not considered to be any risk at all or negligible risk to New Zealand. So the assumption here was that this crew was going to be put on a ship and they would then be treated as though they were not in New Zealand. But the trouble with this, of course, is it just exposes us to a greater opportunities for errors to occur. And we can see that that might have contributed to this current case in New Zealand.
Yeah, given how we know now about how it's transmitted, how easily it can be transmitted, they would have had to come from the airport to the hotel, no testing, from the hotel to the port, from the port to the ship. And so there they are, they're now on the boat. And then you'd have to say the unfortunate marine engineer who was on the boat, who came on the boat to do the work, or he was there when they arrived, he was wearing full PPE gear, and so would have assumed that he was safe.
That's right. Well, again, without knowing what the investigation has shown, it's hard. We can't be certain. I mean, that would be obviously very high on the list of hypotheses about how that engineer was infected. But that's really the subject of the current investigation. And, of course, we have the genome evidence, the lineage that infected the New Zealand engineer was not one that had been seen in New Zealand. So the key bit of information will be if we can get samples from the crew, the crew that was on that ship, the new crew. And I think that's that ship, of course, has sailed now. So we have to wait until it arrives in its next port and they can be tested. But that would be would help, obviously, with the investigation and reconstructing what went wrong.
So I believe the ship's on its way to Brisbane, so when they get there, they'll be tested, and then you'll be able to put this all into the system and try and work out what, you know, where this came from?
Yeah, given the way this virus circulates on ships, it can actually persist for weeks because it can move from person to person. And even with a crew of 20, the modelling work we've done has shown that it could persist for 4 weeks or even longer. So just being at sea, you can actually sustain transmission for a long time in an enclosed environment like that. So if this was the source, I think when the ship gets to Brisbane, there'd still be a reasonable chance of detecting it.
Michael, was this a scenario that anybody had thought of?
Well, I hope they have, because all of these processes now have a very active risk assessment. I'm not exactly sure which agency would have looked at this particular sequence of events in detail. I mean, sometimes there are several agencies working together on this. But yes, they should certainly have considered this possible scenario, and they must at some point have decided that the risk was very low and manageable.
So if it does work out that the information comes through that this is how this transmission occurred, this border incursion, then your modelling will have to expand to include this, the crews that are arriving and in transit through New Zealand, I assume.
That's right. And what often the limitations of modelling, and actually we haven't looked at the particular scenario that you're describing, is most of the times when things go wrong, it's not something that anyone has particularly anticipated or modelled. And we haven't actually been involved at all in this particular situation. I actually wasn't aware that was even occurring, but I'm not actually involved in looking at these particular situations. But yes, I think every time there is a mistake, we need to learn from that and improve our processes.
You come to it after the event, really, don't you?
That's right. Well, I'm not in the decision-making system. I mean, we're always trying to look at these events from, I guess, a research and epidemiological perspective. But there are agencies that are much closer to the operational details. And you can see there are a lot of steps in this process. And I guess one of the lessons that we get is that from this kind of situation is the more steps involved, the more there is the potential for error. And that's often how things go wrong.
Absolutely, because now you have to look at where the marine engineer has been, and is there modelling going on as to how many people he could have potentially come in contact with at the moment? I'm sure there is.
Well, what in an investigation, it's not usually so much around modelling. It's often more around reconstructing the events and looking at plausible opportunities for contact. And we have to always remember that the virus is mainly transmitted from close contact in indoor environments. So it's these respiratory droplets are very good. We think that aerosols that can be suspended in the air for minutes to maybe a few hours can also transmit the virus, but the evidence there is not as strong. And the same for surfaces. You know, we talk about fomite transmission, where these droplets have landed on a surface and then been touched by another person. The evidence for that is very low, for that being an important mode of transmission. It gets a lot of attention, but it actually has very rarely been demonstrated.
And Michael, what do you make of the situation that the world is in at the moment? We're lucky here at the moment, all things considered. When you see what's going on around the planet, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think just despair, really. But actually, it's worth thinking a bit more about how the world is now dividing up, because in the Asia, East Asia region and the Australasian region, we're all going for this elimination approach. And even though Australia is finding it quite tough in Victoria, five states and territories in Australia have done just as well as New Zealand at really having months now of no community transmission. And if you look at Taiwan, it's in the same situation. You know, mainland China is protecting most of its 1.4 billion people. Vietnam's doing very well. Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Mongolia, and South Korea, Japan, Singapore. You know, it's a long list of countries that are largely containing the virus and having long periods of no transmission. So really the world is split now into this hemisphere, which is generally doing very well, and the economy is also starting to pick up. And we've just heard that China's economy really is going to be expanding from last year, the rate it's going, and same for Taiwan. And then we've got really, if you like, the Western world, Europe, North America, who are doing very badly. And it's because they made a poor assessment of the risk of this virus and have decided we're going to just suppress it and try and live with it. And I think that has turned out to be a very bad choice.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Karen.
That's epidemiologist Dr. Michael Baker.